Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. June 6th, 1944, D-Day. It was arguably the most important day of the 20th century. It was a day that marked the start of the Allied invasion of Hitler's fortress Europe.
Now, just offshore, the convoy unloads. Heavily armed troops swarm into barges to head for shore and the assault on France. A signal corps camera slate tells the story. Went in D-Day, 8 hour plus 30 minutes.
In just a few minutes, I'll talk with New York Times best-selling author Alex Kershaw about the Normandy landings. His latest book is titled The First Wave, The D-Day Warriors Who Led the Way to Victory in World War II. It's a book that follows some of the men who carried out D-Day's most perilous missions, and it draws on Kershaw's more than 20 years of research, his close friendships with D-Day survivors, and an intimate understanding of the Normandy battlefield. But before that conversation, I thought it would be interesting to get a sense of what D-Day means to people today. So, a few days ago, on a bright, sunny afternoon, I spoke with a few people in the beer garden of Big Grove in Iowa City.
So, what does D-Day mean to you?
World War II, the invasion of Normandy, was it?
Yeah. Yeah. What images come to mind?
Band of Brothers, the beach, the destruction, that sort of thing.
I just think of World War II, honestly, and then I think about what an important role the U.S. played in World War II.
I would probably agree with the beach. That's the first image that pops in my mind, but I don't know a whole lot other than that, honestly.
What images aside from the beach?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I honestly don't know.
D-Day? Like the end of the world?
No, I mean, D-Day, what images come to mind?
Like from the war.
Probably Normandy, yeah. The beach.
What does D-Day mean to you?
It's D-Day.
What comes to mind?
Normandy? The beaches?
Right.
Higgins boats.
Pardon me?
Boats. New Orleans has Higgins boats.
Higgins boats?
They were built in New Orleans, and it has an interesting history, and you caught me at a day that I'm not great on my...
You're not up on your Higgins boat history.
No, I'm not. But they were built in New Orleans, and they were like the landing craft on the beach there.
Were these the amphibious vehicles?
Yeah.
You know, when I think about those men on those landing craft, as they saw the beaches and other craft ahead of them, some of which had hit mines, or, you know, were they wondering what went through their mind? You know, sort of, were they cannon fodder in effect? Were they ever going to successfully take the beaches and get to the higher ground? Were they, you know, was this a futile effort? Was it going to be successful? You know, sort of part of a greater sort of mission, greater plan, sort of to retake Europe, sort of on behalf of the Allies. I mean, did they feel part of a bigger enterprise, or were they just scared out of their wits?
Maybe both.
Undoubtedly. Yeah. I mean, and for those survivors that are still with us, you know, we owe them a great debt.
I think of the movie, what's it called? Normandy, I think it was called, directed by, I think, Christopher Nolan. That was just a really good movie and picture about kind of just the different lives that were impacted and how they were impacted. So, yeah.
May I ask how old you are?
I'm 21.
In the early 40s, you could have been one of the ones on the beaches.
Yeah, and?
Do you ever think about that?
No, I haven't.
Okay, I'm asking you to think about that. There were, on that first day of D-Day, there were 10,000 casualties, half of those deaths, on those amphibious vehicles coming on the beaches.
Yeah, I mean, I would have been, I don't know about, like, okay with it, but I would have done it, and, like, I would have just, you know, trusted God that, like, whatever he had planned for me, that I would have, you know, I would have pursued that, you know. Whatever he had planned, like, that's what was going to happen. There's no changing that.
Do you ever put yourself in a what-if situation. What if I had been asked to do what these young people were asked to do in 1944?
I do. I mean, personally, in some ways, maybe would be more in favor for us having a draft, even though I wouldn't personally want to ever go to war, but I feel like our generation and maybe our society as a whole doesn't think about it in the same way when it seems more removed and it's more of a choice as opposed... And this is... I don't know if that's actually true, but I think when I was younger and maybe going to protests or about certain things, like I thought about it in that way, that I think it's easy to not think about what our military and our veterans have been through and our... that we ask them to do, you know.
I don't know if you're like me. Do you ever put yourself in the place of a young man who would have been 19, 20, 18 and asked to do that, to land on one of those beaches, Utah or one of the other beaches?
I have thought about that. I thought about it, you know, as my own kids were growing up and were that age as they graduated high school and went to college and thing, you know, sort of if times were different and, you know, there was a draft or they had military, you know, participate in military service and called to serve their country, you know, sort of one would hope that that would never happen. But, you know, we're grateful for, you know, young men and women that have stepped up and done that all over the world for their respective countries. But, you know, sort of, and, you know, the freedoms that we currently experience are, you know, sort of are a direct consequence of that.
What if, do you ever think about what if D-Day had not turned out as it did?
I guess I'd have never actually thought about that.
I don't think people recognize the extent of loss of life. I mean, I think it's fairly underappreciated. A lot of people probably recognize it, but today, you know, we get worried, you know, and upset and protest when 20 people get killed, but 10,000 people in a single event like that. I just don't think people totally appreciate the loss.
And the sacrifice.
Absolutely.
A few thoughts on D-Day from people I spoke with recently in the beer garden of Big Grove in Iowa City. You heard the voices of Scott of North Liberty, Kaylee of Northeast Iowa, Mitch of Dubuque, Pat of Iowa City, who's originally from Ireland, Amy of Iowa Falls, Nadia, originally from Waterloo, Mike of Dubuque, and Megan from Denver. We're remembering D-Day on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, now let's listen to my recent conversation with journalist and New York Times best-selling author of books on the Second World War, Alex Kershaw. His latest book is The First Wave, The D-Day Warriors Who Led the Way to Victory in World War II. It draws on Kershaw's more than 20 years of research, also on his close friendships with D-Day survivors and an intimate understanding of the Normandy battlefield. The book follows some of the men who carried out D-Day's most perilous missions.
Welcome to the program, Alex.
Great to be with you.
Let's start off before we get into really the narratives of some of these amazing men. There are so many who do not have D-Day in their living memory listening to this and may find it hard to grasp the enormous significance of June 6, 1944. As I said, you have led tours of the D-Day beaches for the National World War II Museum and are often asked to speak about D-Day. Take us back to the eve of D-Day, please. Set the scene and remind us what was at stake.
Okay, 5th of June, 1944, over 170,000 Allied soldiers and airmen and sailors are preparing to launch the greatest and most difficult and risky amphibious operation in history. By the end of the Second World War in Europe, 19 million civilians will lie dead. On the eve of D-Day, you have millions enslaved by Nazism, over 4 million Jews already killed in the Holocaust, all of Europe under Nazi occupation except for part of Italy. The Nazi jackboot has been smashed hard down on the European population for almost 4 years. So we are embarking on the greatest voyage of liberation, the greatest act of altruism in American history, over 2,500 Americans will be killed on D-Day, over 900 on one beach alone, Omaha. It's the greatest achievement in American history, I believe. It was the beginning of the end of the most evil regime in modern history, Nazism.
Take us to Omaha Beach. You have the narratives of a couple of amazing figures who were on that beach, Lieutenant John Spaulding, Sergeant Philip, is it Strasek, do you say his name that way, of the 1st Infantry?
Strasek, yeah. They were E Company, 16th Infantry Regiment of the Big Red One. The Big Red One was the only American infantry division to arrive from the sea, one of three that had actually seen combat before. And those two guys achieved something absolutely remarkable. I really can't have enough praise for what they achieved. They landed at H hour, 6:30, 2 a.m. On Omaha Beach, and they were the first Americans to lead other Americans off that killing zone under unimaginably hellish conditions, and men being killed all around them, constant machine gun fire, walking through minefields, and finally, around about 8 o'clock in the morning, they were the first two Americans to lead others off that killing zone, and in doing so, they became an inspiring example, a very important example of what needed to be done elsewhere on that beach. Courage from young leaders like Spaulding and Strasek was what won the day on Omaha Beach. It had nothing to do with the generals who mainly fouled up the operation at Omaha, certainly. It was all about young combat leaders like Strasek and Spaulding getting petrified young Americans to stand up and walk into machine gun fire and attack and advance and get the job done.
Mm-hmm. What was it that didn't go right with Omaha Beach in contrast with Utah Beach, for example? What went wrong?
We carried out the most effective carpet bombing, you could argue, in history on Utah. We bombed laterally, so that meant that the bombers, just before American soldiers landed, we flew parallel to the beach, and we bombed the hell out of all the German defenses. In fact, one in six bombs that we dropped there actually hit their targets. On Omaha, we did the opposite. We bombed horizontally, so that the planes above cloud cover, so they couldn't see their targets, flew across the English Channel and then across the beach. And because of fears that we might have cases of friendly fire, we might drop bombs on our own troops arriving in the first wave, they timed the bomb drop for about a couple of seconds later than when they crossed the coast. So a lot of French cows were killed and some civilians, but not a single defensive installation on Omaha Beach, 6 mile long, deadly beach, not a single defensive installation was hit by Allied bombing before the invasion. So when the guys arrived, when Spaulding and Strasek arrived, they'd been told it would be a cakewalk, that they wouldn't even get their feet wet, that the real fighting would happen once they were ashore. They saw to their astonishment and shock that nothing had been touched. There were no craters on the beach in which to take cover. The elaborate German defenses on the beach had not been touched. And so they arrived in a death trap, and everything that could have gone wrong did go wrong in Omaha, where over 2,500 Americans were casualties, more than 900 killed. And then you contrast that with Utah, where everything did go right, where we had less than 200 casualties, 10 times less on the other American beach.
Mm-hmm. Many of us, many of our listeners will have seen Saving Private Ryan, those first amazing, I don't know, 20 minutes of the film.
Yeah.
Was that a description of what Omaha was like, a depiction?
I don't think you're going to get any closer than that on film. There are very notable differences between that and reality. There's the smell of human blood. There's the constant wail of noise. A survivor of Omaha Beach told me that when he arrived, there was a constant wall of noise. There was, in Saving Private Ryan, you had intermittent sounds of killing, machine gun fire, mortar, artillery. In reality, what happened when you came ashore was that you couldn't hear yourself think, and you couldn't, if you shouted as loud as you could, guys a few yards away couldn't hear you because the noise was just absolutely constant and enormous. There's the smells, obviously, that you can't replicate, but the veterans that I've talked to that were there, actually on that sector of Omaha Beach, it was Dog Green and Charlie sector, the most deadly sector of Omaha, they said it came as close as anything could to what really happened there, which was basically slaughter.
If you just joined us, Alex Kershaw is my guest. The First Wave, his book, The D-Day Warriors Who Led the Way to Victory in World War II. Let's talk about a few of the other amazing narratives you have here. Lieutenant Colonel Terence Ottaway was a British officer who led perhaps the most perilous mission, the seizing of this, is it Maryville battery of guns. Talk us through that quickly, and what was the plan there, and how well did it succeed?
Otway had arguably the toughest job on D-Day, although the Rangers at Point de Hoc, who had to scale 120-foot cliffs, that was a pretty tough nut to crack, as the Brits would say, and you guys would say. But Otway had to, actually the plan for Otway was to seize a battery of guns. Some of the critical missions on D-Day were to seize guns, so the guns at Point de Hoc, the battery and guns at Merville, some 50 miles away. These were key objectives. You had to take those batteries out so that they would not fire on the invasion troops several hours later. They were aimed at the invasion beaches, and we had to destroy them, otherwise thousands and thousands more men would have been killed. So Otway actually, his plan for Otway was to actually crash land into a battery in gliders that were set loose at 6,000 feet, to actually crash land in three gliders on top of the actual guns themselves. Now, when I say that to you, that's actually deadly serious. That was the plan. It seems completely suicidal, mm-hmm. and in fact it was. He landed, he was supposed to take the battery with 600 men and eventually only had around about 150. So even so, he carried on, and of those 150, more than half of them were killed or wounded. So if you want to pick one mission on D-Day, one leader and one mission that costs more, that was more risk, that was more deadly, there isn't one. It's that amazing seizure of the Merville battery with a quarter of the force that was intended against all odds early on June the 6th, 1944.
Mm-hmm. One of these pre-invasion actors here that made a big difference, Captain Frank commander of the 1st American Pathfinders to jump into Normandy. Tell us, what were Pathfinders and what was his mission?
He had probably the most important mission of anybody that dropped from the air, which was that he led 18 guys, a stick of 18 guys, in the very first plane that crossed the English Channel. And his job was to set up Eureka radar sets and bright halogen lights that would guide in the main skytrain of C-47 planes carrying the 101st Airborne. So he and 18 guys dropped in there at 12:15 a.m. on D-Day. He actually put his boots on the ground, the first American to land in Normandy, at 12:15 a.m., and they had about half an hour to set up a series of lights and radars that would guide in all of the other American airborne paratroopers in the 101st Airborne. 6,500 guys would eventually jump. But unless those lights were set up, unless they were able to be guided, then those guys wouldn't have been able to drop where they were supposed to drop. So it was a very, very important mission. They were described as the spearhead of the spearhead of the spearhead of the Allied invasion.
Mm-hmm. And how well did it go for him?
They mislanded by about a mile and a half, but he didn't have time to go where he was supposed to be, so he very quickly rethought the plan and set the lights up in a different location. But that became drop zone A, and in fact, the lights came on at the right time, and the planes coming in carrying all those young American paratroopers, they were able to be guided to more or less where they should have been, but it wasn't absolutely accurate.
Mm-hmm. These amazing narratives are largely about men that we don't know their names, typically connected with D-Day, but you bring out their bravery and the difference they made on D-Day. But I found your account of General Eisenhower, the Supreme Allied Commander, meeting with troops on June 5th before the launch so moving. To imagine what he must have felt like, General Eisenhower... Yep. When he knew he was sending many of these men to their deaths.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he had his driver, after he'd met with the 101st Airborne at Greenham Common, he walked among these young Americans, all of them seemingly cheerful. He had bright blue eyes and a big grin on his face. He was the charming Ike that we know from so many episodes in American history, but inside, he was very, very, very worried. He was not confident of success at all, far from it. smoking 60 cigarettes a day, filled with cigarettes. He had a shake in his right hand, a palsy in his right hand from nerves and having signed so many orders and documents that he had to use not a pen but a soft lead pencil, a constant ringing in his right ear, and yet he was beaming and smiling as he looked these young men in their eyes. And he said to his driver that, you know, there's nothing harder than to look at a 21-year-old guy from Iowa, from Michigan, from California, from Massachusetts, and know that that young man is going to jump almost certainly to their death. Mm-hmm. 80% of the American paratroopers that he met that evening were predicted to become casualties. 8 out of 10 of those guys that whose hands he shook, who he looked into the eyes, he knew that they would be come back. They wouldn't. They'd be killed or wounded. So that's a huge, huge, monumental emotional challenge for just a, you know, a 53-year-old guy that was in charge of the most important invasion in history.
Mm-hmm. What can you tell us after knowing some of these men, some of these heroes personally, about that mindset when you're about to go into D-Day? You said, you know, some of them were cracking jokes, some of them were jolly. How can you be in such a mindset when you're facing such an insurmountable challenge?
Well, number one, the officers that most of the guys I write about are officers, young officers, and they were afraid of dying. Of course you're afraid of dying, but you're more afraid of failing. You're more afraid in particular of failing the men that you're going to lead. A lot of the guys I write about were leading men in combat for the first time, and that was the foremost thing in their mind. The anxiety was caused by the fear that they might fail to do the job and to keep their men alive. But surprisingly, I mean, I guess it might be surprising to some of your listeners, but a lot of these guys, 101st Airborne, some of the elite troops, the Rangers at Point de Hoc, they were excited. They were pumped up. They were raring to go. As they crossed the English Channel, the British glider force that took Pegasus Bridge, they were singing beer songs. They were singing Cockney classics at the top of their voices. The American paratroopers that dropped first into Normandy were singing their hearts out. It was as if they were going to a party rather than to their deaths. They were very, very buoyant and upbeat and confident, and they had been trained to be so, and they knew that confidence is everything. You have to believe that you'll live. You have to believe that you're not going to be the guy that's going to get the bullet between the eyes, and you have to have supreme confidence to face those kind of challenges. You have to believe that you're going to win and you're going to live.
In just a moment, we pick up my conversation with journalist and New York Times bestselling author of books on the Second World War, Alex Kershaw. We're talking about his latest book, The First Wave: The D-Day Warriors Led the Way to Victory in World War II. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A little later in the program today, we'll listen back to some of my visit from 2015 with Iowan George Dane. George was involved in the Battle of the Bulge toward the end of World War II. He died in 2018 at the age of 95. But first, let's finish up my conversation with journalist and New York Times bestselling author of books on the Second World War, Alex Kershaw. His latest book follows some of the men who carried out D-Day's most perilous missions. It's titled The First Wave: The D-Day Warriors Who Led the Way to Victory in World War II. It draws on Kershaw's more than 20 years of research, also on his close personal friendships with D-Day survivors, and his intimate understanding of the Normandy battlefield.
Several times in your account of the D-Day invasion, Alex Kershaw, we hear of the friendly fire killing, injuring Allied soldiers, in some cases in large numbers. How common was that in the big picture of the D-Day invasion?
It was, you know, war is chaos and carnage, and, you know, we've all heard the term the fog of war. Well, it's a very, very thick fog indeed when you're landing so many men under such enormously difficult conditions with terrible weather, with a lot of Allied intelligence was faulty and incorrect. War is chaos and carnage, and there was there were a lot of incidents of friendly fire. In fact, one officer who landed on Omaha Beach, which was the deadliest beach, said that he lost more men that day, not landing and crossing the beach, which was pretty tough in itself, but later on in the day when the Allied Navy started to fire at targets inland, and they were misdirected, and he lost a lot of guys and was very angry about it. You know, thought it was unforgivable that these guys had risked their lives early that morning, had achieved the almost impossible, only to be killed by their own side later that day. So that's war. It happens a lot, and it happened a lot in World War II.
This was really an entertaining part of the book where you gave the account of the Scotsman and the bagpiper. Is it Bill Millen landing with the British on Sword Beach? He wore a kilt, nothing under it, you point out.
Yeah, I mean, it was very cold that day, so I won't mention what was underneath the kilt, but they were very small indeed by the end of the day. He was the only Allied soldier to be able to play the bagpipes. We'd actually banned the playing of bagpipes after World War I because it attracted artillery fire. But he served under Lord Lovat, who was this incredibly romantic and effective commando leader, who said, you know, stuff the regulations. I'm a Scotsman. You're a Scotsman. You're going to wear a kilt and you're going to play Scottish Highland classics as we take that beach. And that's exactly what he did. You'd imagine under terrible, terrible conditions, people dying all around you, this guy, Bill Millen, walked up and down three times the invasion beach in the first wave. So extraordinary story, but, you know, typically kind of eccentric and British, but beautiful for all that, you know.
Do you have a bagpipe tune that he would have played that we could perhaps reconstitute here?
There's one called Highland Lassie. There's several I mentioned in my book. He actually played. He went through the whole songbook of classic Scottish Highland songs that day. And literally, whenever he stopped playing, Lord Lovat would turn to him and say, "Piper, play us a tune." And they piped their way ashore and piped all the way inland. And Millen said after the war that, you know, thankfully he survived, but he said after the war that it lifted people's spirits. They, you know, at one point a sergeant came over to him when he was on the beach that very early that morning, and he was playing. He'd been playing for about 15, 20 minutes, and suddenly someone, you know, punched him in the shoulder and said, "What the hell are you doing playing the pipes? This is crazy, absolutely crazy. Every German's, you're going to attract every German around here playing these pipes." But he said that for all of the people that listened to him play, he thought that he'd lifted their hearts in some way. They'd given them some spirit and some confidence.
Tell us about some of the new technology that was tried out, used in the D-Day invasion. For instance, I found it amazing the use of tanks with inflated skirts to float them onto the beaches. Many of them did not work as designed.
Yeah, they were called DD tanks, Donald Duck tanks was the nickname, and they were actually Sherman tanks that had an envelope around them, a cloth envelope that inflated. And in calm seas, they actually worked. I mean, on a lake in England, it all went pretty smoothly, but in the English Channel, on the June 6th, 1944, unfortunately, they were pretty stormy conditions, six-foot waves and battering surf. And sadly, tragically, a lot of those floating tanks actually didn't float. They sank. And in fact, off Omaha Beach, in one sector out of 32 tanks, only two made it to the shore. So,
and these were tanks with tank crews in them.
Yeah, no, I mean, imagine. I mean, a Sherman tank being delivered into water and sinking immediately. I mean, you were very lucky to get out alive if you could at all. They literally were dropped into their deaths, you know.
When you wrote this book and researched this book about the D-Day warriors, what are the ways in which your account differs from other accounts? There's been so much written about this. Arguably the most significant day of the 20th century.
Well, what I wanted to do, I didn't want to write a sort of long Wikipedia entry, which is unfortunately most military history. I wanted to focus on the stars and celebrate them unashamedly. And I wanted to take a very dramatic moment-by-moment focus. I didn't want to go you know, one beach, second beach, third beach, fourth beach, fifth beach. I go moment by moment from the June the 5th, and I follow just 10 key characters, the most the guys that I think either epitomized the ultimate heroism that was required or carried out the most important jobs. Guys who hadn't, if they hadn't succeeded, D-Day wouldn't have succeeded. So I wanted it to be very tight, very focused, very human. I wanted to go inside the minds and the hearts of these guys as they fought on the most important day of the 20th century, and I wanted to make it an unashamed celebration of what it really, really cost and what it took to get that job done. And it took enormous courage and trauma and unbelievable human spirit to be able to succeed that day, and these guys did it, and I wanted to celebrate that unashamedly.
Alex, in your book, you point to Ronald Reagan, President Reagan's speech in 1984 in Normandy on the 40th anniversary as the best speech, I think you said. Why?
Because, number one, he was, whatever you think of his politics, he was a fantastic orator. Second, Peggy Noonan was the speechwriter, and she's a hell of a writer. And third, he was able to do what every American president has to do when they go to Normandy and stand beside all those 9,850 American dead in Colville-sur-Mer graveyard or wherever they stand in Normandy. They have to connect today's world with what happened in 1944. And they have to say very loudly and clearly that this was America's finest hour, that those lives were sacrificed to liberate Europe for Europeans. There was no chance in 1944 of the Nazis frog marching down the Mall in Washington. That sacrifice was purely altruistic. It was for Europeans. It was to set millions of Europeans free. And we have to connect that finest shining hour, that best moment in American history from my point of view, with today. And we have to link the ability and the willingness of America to sacrifice for others abroad, to bring freedom and prosperity and democracy to countries abroad, to the oppressed. We have to constantly link that with the achievement of D-Day, which was about doing that precisely in Europe in 1944 for millions and millions and millions of people.
Let's hear a little bit of that speech from Ronald Reagan in 1984 in Normandy on the 40th anniversary of D-Day. Okay, I know we're running short of time. We have 5 minutes, I think. Alex, in your account, you follow some of the main figures, these men who tipped the balance in favor of the Allies on D-Day. You followed their lives after the war. They often had a tough time adapting to civilian life. We spoke of Frank Lilleyman. These men made a difference on D-Day, but had a tough haul when they returned to civilian life often, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what you have to remember is that D-Day was the first day for some of these guys, and people like Lilleyman that you mentioned, and also John Spaulding at Omaha Beach, several of the characters I write about in great detail. It was the first day of many, many, many days of extreme trauma and combat. And combat is trauma. Anybody that has been to war will tell you, you never come back unchanged. You are permanently affected, often seriously psychologically damaged by war. It is the worst thing that man can do to mankind. So, yes, they were victorious and they were glorious on D-Day. But day after day after day, they carried on fighting. There was a long way to go from Omaha Beach and Utah Beach to Berlin, well over 1,000 miles. And every day, these guys had to get up again, day after day, get up out of their foxholes and move forward, advance towards victory. And it cost them enormously. And there's only so much that the body and the mind can take. Psychiatrists estimated that after around 200 days of combat in World War II, you were broken. It didn't matter how strong you were. You could be a Superman, but you were psychologically broken. You went insane. So those guys were seriously damaged by what they achieved, which was victory in World War II, but it cost them a lot.
How much of their understanding at that time and their treatment of what we call today PTSD is different than today? Combat fatigue, I think, is the term was used at that time.
Well, it was a very, very widespread recognition of the damage that was being done to the nervous system and the mind by combat in World War II. It worried senior Allied planners and leaders greatly. We were having, you know, widespread breakdown of troops all across the European theatre by 1944, certainly as you go past D-Day, a lot of men were being broken by combat, and we did a lot of studies about it. We looked into it. We began to treat it very seriously. No longer was it a case of being a coward. A lot of the veterans that I've spoken to over the years, in fact, a couple of combat commanders said that they really pitied guys that broke down, that suffered from severe combat trauma, because they knew in their own minds that that would happen to them sooner or later. It was just a question of time. How long could you last before you broke? And so there was a wide recognition that a lot was done at the time. There was a lot of treatment, a lot of innovation that happened during World War II in all aspects of medical treatment of the condition. But it didn't change the fact that because of the nature of the warfare, because it was so intensely violent, you had an industrial war, you had young men being thrown into industrial slaughter, that it really, really did an enormous amount of damage very quickly to a lot of people, and you didn't last long until you were seriously affected by the combat. So, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, by the time we got to Vietnam, we were much more aware of what combat does to the human mind. But in World War II, we knew we had a very, very serious and very widespread problem of people being very damaged by the experiences they were enduring day by day.
Alex Kershaw, before we go, very quickly, could you tell us what you see as the lessons from D-Day that we would do well to remember today, 75 years later?
Combat racism wherever you can. Combat fascism. Combat nationalism. Combat isolationism. Stay with your allies and give everything you can to preserve freedom and democracy and to be united with allies in Western Europe, Britain, France, whoever. America and Europe need to be as close as possible, because it's the foundation of modern civilization and the Atlantic Alliance. It is everything that matters. We need to preserve it, and we need to be very, very concerned by anything that ever smacks of fascism and nationalism ever again.
That finishes up my recent conversation with Alex Kershaw, author of The First Wave, The D-Day Warriors Who Led the Way to Victory in World War II. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we have a little bit of time left, so let's go back to listen to some excerpts from a conversation I had with World War II combat veteran and Iowan George Dane. Dane died in January of 2018 at the age of 95. I visited him at his Iowa City home in 2015. George was involved in the famous Battle of the Bulge toward the end of the war. It was Hitler's last-ditch effort to repel the Allied forces. Now, at the point we're starting my conversation with George Dane, the Germans in 1944 had just begun their surprise offensive, and George's unit was about to be overrun.
We had some roadblocks there, but they overran those. The tank came down into the street and must have seen some activity around, but anyway, he stopped right in front of the hotel that we were in. Took his machine gun and shot out all the windows, and then turned his turret 90 degrees and fired one round through the front door of this little hotel.
The hotel you were in?
Yeah. And by coincidence, I was on the second floor. I was the transportation officer, and I was on the telephone working with the other officers trying to line up some trucks, get some other people to come and help us when this fired through the front door. The guy that survived went to the basement, and we didn't know what we were going to do. But up on the third floor, there was a little catwalk, some 2x12s. They led on a little catwalk back to the cliff, just like I say up at McGregor, and that's where we got away. And my nephew went back, and the hotel is still there. It's used now as a regular hotel, but he said the little catwalk that we got away on is still there too.
Still there.
And I knew the road net, because that was my work with the trucks. It was dark, pitch black, but you'd have any sense of a direction. But Signal Corps had taken these 36-inch searchlights that they used to use for airplanes and then used for openings for used car lots, but anyway, and shined those off the clouds and made artificial moonlight.
Hmm.
So I could tell which way was west and which way it was east. And so naturally I went west.
And you eventually found an intact unit that had not been overrun.
Yeah. So anyway, I got past that, hooked up another guy for a little while, found some lady that fed us a little something to eat. So then on the main road that went from Bastogne back east to Clairvaux, where we were I found a part of a column of my trucks, supply trucks, that's what it was in. And so I got those guys, and they hadn't had anything to eat or anything. So I bedded them down. Must have been about 8 o'clock at night. And then we heard some noises in the background. And I said, guys, I don't like the sound of that. And I said, I think we better leave. Well, I got them up. We got them and we had six trucks, got them started. And what I heard was a German tank coming down the road. And he saw the column, and he fired at the last truck. Well, he hit the gas tank or something like that. Anyway, set it on fire. But the driver jumped out of the truck, grabbed the tailgate of the one in front. We kept going. Mm-hmm. Well, that burning truck was in the middle of the road, so the tank couldn't follow us, you see. And so we went on back west and back to our supply dumps, and that's how we got out of that.
George, did you lose any friends during the war?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Fullback of our high school team lost an arm. Quarterback lost both legs. There's one family. They had two sons, lost them both. I think there was three families we knew that had two kids and lost them both. We were our classes, as I say, were hit real hard. You know, normal thing, you know, you'd lose 1 or 2% of your people. Some of those classes, lost 10% of them. Of killed, and then a lot of them wounded.
When you think back, does it seem like it's been 70 years since you had those experiences?
Well, yes and no, because some of this dims by age, but some of it is just as clear as a bell. I can remember as a first-year student, and the guy that taught me close-order drill as a junior, he was killed. You know, that hits you real hard. Well, you take a school that's all men, and they all have had military experience, and at that particular age, left out a lot of holes.
Mm-hmm. How often these days do you think about the war? Every day, would you say?
No. You learn put that behind you. There's other things that take up your time, take up your thoughts. One of the other things that you learn is you don't taste too much about your experience, because you never know the guy next to you that had it worse.
Yep.
And a very good friend of mine was down in the South Pacific for 15 months. Made a sergeant, did very well, came back, had 6 weeks OCS, and everybody said, well, you've done your duty, they'll keep you stateside. So then he got married. Next week he got orders to go to Germany, and he got captured. So, you know, you don't say too much. There, the guy had it out worse.
That was a bit of my conversation from 2015 with World War II combat veteran and Iowan George Dane. George died in 2018 at the age of 95. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Caitlin Harrop, and help today from Stephanie Nobrega. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime at our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.